Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we hear from legendary television journalist and news anchor Dan Rather. Mr. Rather recently spoke at Boston University as part of a celebration marking the 45th anniversary of the Howard Gotlieb Archival Research Center. Introducing Mr. Rather is Dr. John LaRosa, president of the Friends of the Libraries at Boston University.
Mr. Dan Rather is with us tonight. And he has set the standard for broadcast reporting for over 50 years. In that time, he has covered nearly every major world news event, and his archive at the Howard Gotlieb Center reflects the diversity of his reportage. He is a distinguished anchorman, an intrepid and trusted reporter, and a dedicated and passionate journalist. One need only view the exhibition of his papers at the center to have a sense of the enormous variety of subjects on which he has reported. Mr. Rather began as an Associated Press correspondent in his home state of Texas. He later worked as a reporter at local television and radio stations before beginning a four-decade career at CBS News in 1962. Currently, Dan Rather is exploring the cutting edge of the new media by hosting the weekly news program Dan Rather Reports on HDNET. Dan Rather Reports focuses on hard field reports, in-depth interviews, and investigative pieces on politics, the global economy, and international affairs. He has won numerous awards, and many of his Emmy Awards are currently in exhibition at the library next door. He is one of the most widely known American journalists, and his own words summarize his mission, and I quote, "Being a reporter is all I could ever remember wanting to do." Ladies and gentlemen, will you join me in welcoming our guest, Mr. Dan Rather?
Thank you. Thank you very, very much. Thank you for being here. Thank you for having me here. You know, we have some limited time. I have a few things I want to say to you, some of which are important to me, some others of which you will pick up, examine, and see whether they're important to you. But as we go through this, a couple of things are very important to me. Some nice things have been said from up here in the introduction, and which I appreciate greatly, but I trust all of you, particularly your students who remember your civics class, know what Abe Lincoln said about generous introductions. He said, "Never take time to deny it. The audience will find out the truth soon enough for themselves." And so it will be with you. I also trust, particularly with you students, that you may have noted that in this introduction, there was very little said about my university or college education. There's a reason for that, that I am a graduate of Sam Houston State Teachers College in Huntsville, Texas. I'm very proud of that, but we consider our school the Boston University of our part of the world, but we're perfectly aware a lot of people this far north never heard of the damn place. That they gave me about all the education I was capable of absorbing, but it's very important to go through tonight. I have some ground I want to cover with you, and we will take questions at the end. But there may be experts on the geopolitical shifts around the globe. There may be experts on the advance of technology and breakthroughs of science. But if so, you'd be surprised how few of those experts graduated from Sam Houston State Teachers College. So I hope you will keep that in mind as we go along tonight. I prepared a speech. Now, to use a Texas word, I reckon this is going to take me 45 minutes to read through this speech. You'll be pleased and relieved to know that I'm not going to read a word of it. I will leave it with Vita. And if anybody wants a copy, I'm sure she can run it off her fax machine. This is not a lecture and microphone technique on my part. I intended to do this, but I recognize we have some time imperatives here. So let me come back to something I touched on earlier, which is, understand what you're dealing with here with me. And this is not a case of my just sort of looking at my feet and running the hands around the brim of my hat and saying, oh, shucks. I am basically, in fact, fundamentally, a reporter who got lucky, very, very lucky. And if you're a student and saying to yourself, you know, how the heck did this guy get there, wherever you may imagine there to be? How did he get where he is? Well, I can tell you, because I've lived it, that it's primarily, yes, I worked hard, not as hard as some people I worked with in the oil fields early on, but yes, I worked hard, and yes, I had my Polar Star out there and all those things. But just understand that you can, particularly in journalism, but I think this is true in a lot of fields, you can be doing a lot of the right things in the right way for a long time, but if you don't get a break, if God doesn't smile and the right people aren't watching at the right time, your break may be slower to come and it may never come. So just understand what you're dealing with here. I'm not an expert on one thing. Having said to you, I don't know of any experts that graduated from Sam Houston State Teaching College when I went there. I'm not an expert. I don't claim to be. I'm a reporter who got lucky. I'm happy to talk to you about where the country is, where the election is for the moment, but just keep in mind what I said to you before. And I was going to point out to you, since I am in a citadel of scholarship, academics, and intellectualism in the best sense of the word, that Sam Houston is located in Walker County, Texas. Walker County is in East Texas. It's behind what we call the Pine Tree Curtain. They're very, very proud people in Walker County, and I owe them a lot. One of the things that they are proudest of is there is not now, nor has there ever been in the entire history of Walker County, not one single intellectual. And they take tremendous pride in this. And if it's any interest to you, the definition of an intellectual in Walker County is if you can listen to the William Tell Overture and not think of the Lone Ranger, you are an intellectual. So please keep that in mind as we go along. Now, we're in the middle of what, in my opinion, and let me clearly italicize that word, my opinion, is an historic presidential election year. You can say, well, what else is new? Dan, where'd you get your first clue? Not exactly bulletin material. But it's worth reminding ourselves that if for no other reason, and there are plenty of other reasons, if for no other reason, and however you feel about the candidacy one way or the other, the fact that the candidate for president of the United States from one of the two major parties is a person of color, would that alone would make this a historic campaign, whether Barack Obama wins the presidency or not. It makes it a campaign that history books, for as far ahead as you can imagine, are going to at least mention this year's presidential campaign. Now, there are many other aspects of the campaign, most of which have surprised the daylights out of me. It isn't true that I've been covering politics since Sam Houston was writing, but I have been covering it a long while. And one of the reasons I love covering politics, and I confess that I have a passion for covering politics, is because what you most expect frequently does not occur. What you least expect very often occurs. And again, to cause it, to phrase in Texas language, ain't that the truth this time around? That we're the race, as we sit here, in my case, stand here, has already gone. We're now talking about post-primary period. Has already gone through more surprises than most presidential campaigns would exhibit. Everything from the choice of vice president by the Republican candidate, a woman on the ticket, but also I can't remember a race when the naming of a vice presidential candidate has changed the dynamic. You may like it or not like it, but changed the dynamic of a campaign, just by the naming of the vice presidential candidates. You certainly have to go back to 1960, Kennedy versus Nixon, and the naming of Lyndon Johnson as JFK's running mate that year. But I submit to you on the basis of my experience, and let me note that sometimes I'm wrong about these things, that this being a historic presidential campaign, each campaign is special to itself, each presidential campaign is unique to itself, but one we already know has a stronger, deeper historical center of gravity, if you will, than most, that I want to say to you directly that I think the race may get down, I'm often wrong about these things, may get down to, and I submit to you to keep your eye on, late deciders. That in most political races, not all political races, in most political races, a lot of people don't make up their mind until very late. Late deciders in presidential campaigns are generally defined those who make up their minds between Friday midnight and the time they go to the polls Tuesday. In every race, the politicians look at this because sometimes a decided underdog, can come back from far behind with the late deciders. At other times, a very close race, for example, in 1980, you may know this for those of you who read your history of that period, Friday night midnight, Ronald Reagan versus incumbent President Jimmy Carter, the race by acclamation of the polls, dead even. By Sunday night midnight, incumbent President Jimmy Carter was told, we have to start writing your concession speech. And you would expect he would say, what are you talking about? The election is not until Tuesday. Point was, the race was even, but over the weekend, the late deciders began to shift. They shifted in Governor Reagan's direction, and he became president. So for those of you who like to follow this race, I suggest to you keep your eye on the late deciders. It's usually good advice in any election campaign, particularly in a presidential election campaign, but it may be decisive this time, decisive in, there are some options about being decisive, which is to say it could be decisive as to who actually wins, and it could be decisive whether one candidate or the other wins by a rather large margin. Keep in mind that a large margin these days would be 52 to 48. That would be considered a strong win by either candidate. So my reason for mentioning the late deciders, particularly with you in this audience, and for those of you who aren't students, those of you who are, you know, senior, forgive me if you must, but I want to talk directly to these students because here's what I hear so often on college campuses. Man, I'm really involved. I'm really pumped about this election. And I also hear young people are going to make a difference in this election, whatever it is, whether it's 1980s, 1990s, right on into this century. The book, if you will, that is to say the scattering report on young people who get excited about particularly presidential races. And people in politics know this. Journalists talk about it among themselves. They may or may not share it with you. The book on you, that is you, those of you who are younger voters, maybe voting for the first time, maybe the second, in the 18 to 25, 26 category, I'll tell you what the book is. The book is you talk, but you don't walk. You don't get there to the polls. I'm not talking about you individually. You can say, oh, well, I'm going to get there. As a general rule, the so-called youth vote, this is what happens. It gets excited. Sometimes a majority of it seems to get excited for the Republican candidate, sometimes the Democratic candidate. Sometimes it's hard to tell. But the scouting report is they talk big, but they don't deliver. They do not get to the polls. Now, if you believe that this presidential election is one of our more important presidential votes, because of what's happening around the world, what's happening within our own country, or perhaps some issue that you feel strongly about. If you believe that this is a particularly important presidential election, keeping in mind that every presidential election in a country such as ours, a constitutional republic based on the principles of freedom, and democracy, including a free vote. But if you think this one is particularly important, then the question for you is, are you going to talk or are you going to walk? Are you going to be like the previous youth votes in presidential election years that somehow, some way, just doesn't show up, gets an excuse for this or an excuse for that? There's always an excuse. But let me suggest to you that excuse-making is not in the American character, that this is not something that we have, as a country, we as a people and society, have ever been particularly known for. And for some reason, we're free, we're independent, therefore we have a history, a culture of being self-reliant. Well, I don't want to digress, but let me come back to it. Figure a way to get to the polls. I do not care what party you favor. I do not care what candidate that you favor. But I do care that you care enough not to fall into that category which has become the book on the youth vote, that you talk but you don't walk. I want to tell you a story about, this is long ago and far away, when President Johnson came to the presidency through the assassination of President John Kennedy. The presidential election of 1964 was, by and large, when I say a foregone conclusion, that President Johnson was heavily favored because the country had gone through the trauma of the Kennedy assassination in 1963, and it was widely assumed that President Johnson would win. His opponent was, as you know, Barry Goldwater. Senator Goldwater ran a campaign believing there was an outside chance he could win. But nonetheless, President Johnson comes into the presidency, has tremendously positive ideas about social policy, such things as the Voting Rights Act, which changed the dynamic of politics for the rest of the 20th century in this country and beyond. And he was a strong supporter of the Vietnam War because it was his story. I, for one, have believed it, but you can believe it. He was a strong supporter of the war, partly because President Kennedy had been a strong supporter of the war. At any rate, in the 1966 campaign, this is off year. President Johnson's been elected, if you follow me, in 64. Now he wants a Congress that'll stay with him in 1966. Comes up through 66. He's campaigning for Democratic candidates. And he has his mind on running for re-election in 1968, which he could do. At any rate, the war was in many ways not going well. President Johnson, his popularity from the 64 campaign faded. He goes through this period where every time he turns around, he's getting a lot of criticism. He changes press secretaries. He brought in a press secretary from Texas named George Christian. Here's what happened, that Christian came in, straight-talking, sort of a cowboy-type character. He's now gone. He might not appreciate being described that way, but he was sort of taciturn, kind of said, yup, nope, didn't try to over-talk things. President Johnson brought him in and said, George, I got a big problem. He said, one thing is the press keeps going around saying on this Vietnam War, which is not very popular, and they keep saying that I once said, I will not send American boys to do what Asian boys should do for themselves. That's his quote, not mine. But he said to George, he said, and you know, excuse my French here, he said, George, I never said it. This is a case of the press twisting this around, and I'm getting hit over the head. Does this sound familiar to you in any way? Politicians frequently complain about these things. Well, Christian said, well, Mr. President, I'll look into it. I'm not sure I can do anything about it, but I'll look into it. And President said, George, you get out and fix it, because I'm telling you I never said it. Christian did a lot of research. He came back in a few days, and he had in a wheelbarrow, which was his, literally in a wheelbarrow, he had it wheelbarrowed in, and there were stacks of newspaper clips. He said, Mr. President, I'm not through with my research yet, but I do want you to know that I've been looking into it, and the problem may be deeper than you even know, because all these stacks of printed material have you directly quoted, not indirectly quoted. They have you directly quoted as saying what you will not send American boys to do what Asian boys should do for themselves. The president said, you know, George, you know how them lie. I mean, I'm telling you, I never said it. Christian says, it's okay. I'm looking into it. About a week later, he comes back to the president, and he has a tape recorder. In those days, tape recorders were about this size, so-called portable ones, big old-fashioned tape recorders. He said, Mr. President, I want to play you something here. I haven't finished my research, but I just want to tell you what the dimensions of the problem. So he put the tape recorder down, and there was the unmistakable voice of Lyndon Johnson saying, I will not send American boys to do what Asian boys should do for themselves. Well, President Johnson, who also had these huge hands, came down. He practically wrecked the tape recorder. He slammed it down. He says, damn it, George, I thought you were smarter than that. He said, you know what them bitches can do. They take these little razor blades, and they cut these things around. They cut these things around like this and that. He said, I'm really surprised you. And Christian said, okay, Mr. President, I'm looking into it. Short time after that, they have a theater in the White House. You know, the president has a theater of his own. And President Johnson had invited some people to the theater. They were showing, of course, the Alamo, which he always liked to see. And Christian came up to him and said in his ear, Mr. President, when this is over, if you don't mind staying about 10 or 15 minutes, I have something I need to talk to you about. So when it was over, President Johnson motioned him forward, and George said, now, Mr. President, I want you to get mad at me, but I just want to put something up on the screen now that there's only two of us in here. And there is a campaign picture in moving pictures. In those days, it was film, of President Johnson standing on the bumper of his presidential limousine in a dark street corner in Philadelphia saying, I will not send American boys to do what Asian boys should be doing for themselves. There's a pause, the lights come on, and President Johnson turned around and says to Christian, damn, George, you sure that's me? That story, as Dr. Henry Kissinger once said in another context, has the added advantage of being true. I want to leave you with this thought, and one reason for taking you through that, sometimes takes too long to tell the story, I recognize, but it's in the nature of politicians, and by the way, I have tremendous respect for anybody who puts their name on the ballot and has the guts to run, whether I agree with them or not, whether I think they should be running or not. It takes a lot of guts to do that. But it's in the nature of politicians, and particularly this has grown as a trend in recent years, to take the view that they want to command any landscape that they occupy. They want to have what's called, some of them call it, command of the message. And part of the way, and politicians have long wanted to do this, over the years some of them began to develop techniques. But we're now in the 21st century where they've developed the technique to what I consider to be, if not an extreme level, one that you should consider. And it is this. It's a philosophy that goes this way. We, our party, our candidate, name him, we need to command any landscape we occupy. We need to keep command of the message. And to do that, it may be necessary on the press to push back. This would be their words, push back hard. It's a way of, these are my phrase, it's a way of working the refs. Ever been to the basketball game where the coach is constantly walking the sidelines saying things in the referee's ear that you can't hear? Anybody who's been in sports knows what it is to work the refs. Part of it is to work the refs. The other part of it is to induce fear. And not just fear in the individual journalist or the people who work in his or her newsroom. It's also, and in many ways more important, to induce fear into the ownership of the journalistic enterprise. Now, I'm calling your attention to this because if you want to be an informed and intelligent viewer, among the many things that you need to understand about how the game is played, increasingly what's going on, what's really going on, as opposed to what somebody may be trying to convince you what's going on, is this business of, and it is for them, for those in political life, many of them, it is a business of, you can call it what you want, pushback, working the refs, intimidation. But if you aren't aware of it, you need to be aware of it. And where I'm going with this is that increasingly you need to get your news and information from a variety of places. There's a whole other school of thought that says, no, you shouldn't do that. You should decide what it is you believe, decide who it is you're for or what you're for, and then read publications or listen to radio or watch television that agrees with you. My strong recommendation, nothing original or profound in this, is that now more than ever, partly because the one thing I mentioned before, but only part because of that, the more variety that you get in your reading, listening, and viewing about the campaign, the better chance you have of making up your own mind. Now, I find the timekeeper has given me the signal here that it, and we do want to get off on time, that we're going to take some questions and answers. Well, certainly take questions. Whether there are any answers, you'll be the best judge of that. I do subscribe to the idea, which journalists, not everybody, but in general, subscribe to. There are no bad questions. There are only bad answers. And so with that as prelude, are you ready to go? If anybody moves to the microphone, we have one microphone in the middle. Are there any others? Okay, if you're ready, young lady, I am.
Hello.
Howdy.
Mr. Rather, I can't help but notice that the media is dominated by scandals. And I was wondering if you think that that's caused by the public's real desire for these to hear about these scandals and the media is just catering to it, or if you think that the media is playing the role of gatekeepers too much and they're the ones that are interested in the scandals.
Well, it's a very good question. Keep in mind that frequently one person's scandal is another person who may be on the other side of the political eye is their important information to know. But look, I've said it before and I say it to you again, and I do not exclude myself from this criticism. I specifically include myself in this criticism. What's happened in your lifetime, just in your lifetime still, and I may say this in no patronizing way, a young person, there's been a diminution of standards in journalism. The size of the competitive pit, the competitive arena, no excuses here, this is trying to explain, has gotten much larger with the advent of cable, satellite, now more recently the internet. And as the size of the competitive pit got larger, the ferocity of the competition increased. Competition for ratings, and more important today, demographics. You understand the difference. At one time, ratings were everything. Now, even more important to most outlets are demographics, a certain age group. This has led to a diminution in standards. And we all know it, those of us in journalism. What to do about it is a very difficult question. Basically, you know, when it comes to this, at least, I'm old school journalism. I hope it'll be new school journalism. And that is that news should be a public service. And those people in news should have a high degree of sense of responsibility for the public trust that has been put into them. So that says to me that when you should try to report what's important or what, based on your experience and your judgment, is important, rather than go for what's the most interesting. Follow me through here. That sometimes the best story is an important story that's really interesting. But often the call is between something's important and something's titillating. Increasingly what we in journalism have done is say, look, never mind what's important. What do we think will people will see as the most interesting, the most people watching the program at that time? And this is diminished standards. And I'll confess to you, I've gotten some difficulty before by talking about this and may again, but I believe it, which is to say, particularly when it comes to covering international affairs, politics, certainly you want the ratings, certainly you want to get good demographics, but don't make that the only imperative on which you base things. Now, this is seen as a little old-fashioned and very idealistic and in some quarters naive. But I'm committed to both the idea and the ideal, that there's a thirst, there's a hunger for this among the American people. I think particularly the big conglomerates that own most of the media outfits are behind the curve, not ahead of the curve, in judging what it is the public wants when you hang out the shingle news. But I've already given you a longer answer than I intended to, but I've done the best I can. Yes, sir.
Hillary Clinton claimed that she had hit the glass ceiling, although she left 18 million cracks in it. But as a matter of fact, I think the rules of the Democratic Party is what defeated her. If it had not been proportional representation in the primaries, but winner take all, as it was before the McGovern reforms, she would have won in about 6 weeks. Now, when it comes to the president's race, 43 men have been elected president of the United States. But it's important to remember that 43 men didn't. Now, did those 43 that didn't win hit a glass ceiling of some sort? Now, the point of my question is, what conclusion do we reach if Barack Obama is not elected? Is it going to be because of a residual racism in this country that will explain this thing so that a black candidate has hit a glass ceiling? Or will it be mistakes in his campaign or the effectiveness of the opposition's campaign? Now, speaking personally, and I realize that that's not very relevant, I would love to see a person of color elected president of the United States, and I think that's a widely held point of view. On the other hand, I can easily conceive of some possibilities that he may forfeit the chance to win that election just by what his campaign engages in. So how do we judge this when we get through? If he loses, is it going to be a residual racism? And the other thing is, how can we tell why he loses if he loses?
Well, first of all, President Silver, always good to see you. And then it'll take a while. No, it's a serious question, deserves a serious answer. That after the election is over, it will not be until after the election is over and well after the election is over, when we can carefully analyze, if not on a precinct-by-precinct basis, which is my own preference, at least on areas of states and states basis, how the election went. All of the things that Dr. Silver mentioned are a possibility. You know, latent racism, latent or otherwise, is always a possibility. It's always a possibility that someone would want to use that as an excuse. Not turning out one's vote, not getting to the polls, the core constituency for one's party, not making the right appeal to independents and swing voters. Those are sometimes two different things. All these are possibilities. There's no way to know in advance. After the election is over, I say give it 4 months. There'll be a careful analysis, but such analysis is not pure science. It's a crude art on its both days, best days, but we will know no more. What we do know, well, let me scratch that, if you will. Where we are now, in my opinion, again, all caps, italicized, underlined in my opinion, where we are now in the race is, if not the proverbial dead even, a race that is very close. If you are a Republican and saying to yourself, I don't care what the press says, I don't care what the polls say, I'm telling you, John McCain, war hero, run down the list, is going to win this campaign, and it's pretty much a gut cinch, because look at the map. It's all colored red with the prospect of it. Well, I have news for you. It's not a gut cinch. It's not anywhere near that, and the Republican candidate is going to have to fight like the Dickens and perform very well the rest of the way to have a chance to winning. Now, if you're a Democrat and you're saying to yourself, listen, 8 years of one president in any party is a heavy burden, and especially with the new economic problems, the polls may go up and down, but you know what? Barack Obama is going to win, and he may win in a fairly easy glide because it's, quote, a Democratic year. Well, I have a bulletin and flash information for you. You are kidding yourselves. At this point, it's close. It's very close. It could go either way. It certainly could break substantially for one candidate or another, particularly with the late deciders, as I said to you earlier. But now back to the point. This is my story. This is my song for tonight. If you care, if you think this election is important, I'm telling you, as of this reading, it's close. And if you think you can sit it out, then you can. It's free country. Sit it out. But when it's over, don't come back complaining to me how it turned out. I want to see the certification that you voted. Ma'am.
When President Richard Nixon broke the law, impeachment proceedings were started, and he had to resign. We have seen so much lawbreaking in the current administration, and I wonder if you would comment, particularly with regard to Attorney Vincent Bugliosi's book, The Trial of George W. Bush for Murder. Is there a chance that this man will be held accountable after he leaves office, since he hasn't been held accountable while in office? Thank you.
Thank you. Well, first of all, I know of the book, but I have not read the book. But again, you know, I'll try to answer your question. That what happened in the Richard Nixon presidency is that we now know, and it still sticks in my throat a little bit to say so because I didn't want to believe it for a long time, that it was demonstrated that he led a widespread criminal conspiracy from the Oval Office itself, which eventually 43 people, at least 43 people, were convicted. And he resigned as the only president in history to resign as a, quote, unindicted co-conspirator in this widespread criminal. Now, difference was there. Now we're talking 1974 in the Nixon administration. Is a combination of the nation as a whole had reached a consensus. Both houses of the Congress had reached a consensus, and the leadership of the then president's own party had reached a consensus that either he had broken the constitutional requirements of his office, or there was enough evidence to bring him to trial to do something. My point is that we haven't reached that here. Whatever your own feelings about George W. Bush may be, plus or minus, whether you stated as fact, and I'm not arguing with you, that crimes have been committed. Here's the point. We are not now, and not likely to reach, given the short term left in his presidency, to reach that kind of consensus, if you will, almost with the public, both houses of Congress, leadership of his own party, haven't reached that point. So what you're left with is, one, history's judgment, and two, after he leaves office, if that kind of consensus can be raised. But I don't want to kid you. I think that's highly unlikely. I think it's highly unlikely that that will be the case. It will be left, as the cliche goes, for history to judge and what history's verdict will be on him. Yes, sir.
Mr. Rada, I'm very pleased that you didn't come from Crawford, Texas. My name is Gerald Heng, and I'm an alumnus of Boston U and Harvard. I came here as a Fulbright scholar during the time of President Kennedy, and with his very good inaugural speech about the trumpet summoning liberty all across the world. Now, my question may seem like a moral majority kind of Jerry Falwell question, but it's a question that must be asked because a lot of the American people and also a lot of foreigners think that the last two terms, when they elected George W. Bush, the American electorate didn't get a fair shake of the issues because on the Swiftboat veterans, John Kerry fell badly, and on Al Gore, they got the Supreme Court justice and their GOP appointees to nominate George Bush as the president. And during the time of Michael Dukakis, our own governor, who ran for president, they used Willie Horton, the race card. all the networks in this country are supposedly neutral and that you can make commercial purchases on the ads for politics, but isn't there some ethical responsibility of the media and people like yourself, a very distinguished journalist, who can balance the distortion and the character assassination that is being advertised that would sway the voters one way or the other? This is a judicial question. It is not a question of whether you can afford to buy something. It should be a public trust.
Understand.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'll do my best. The answer isn't it something ethical that should be done. Of course, journalism at its best, the best of American journalism, is when you separate, I'm trying to clean this up, when you separate brass tacks from bullshine. That's what it's supposed to be. Now, I talked earlier about fear, about the diminution of the willing to do the tough stuff, which is ask not only the tough questions, but follow-up questions, which are harder to do, and follow-up questions behind that. It is the role, one role of the press, to be a watchdog, as we know. Not an attack dog, which jumps at everything. What does an attack dog do? It jumps at anything that moves, try to tear its throat out. Not an attack dog, but not a lap dog. It crawls up in the lap and just wants to be patted. Nice dog, nice dog. Supposed to be a watchdog, supposed to yap at anything that's suspicious. But there's one thing, and I'll close with this and get to the next question, about this, that I have said that, including myself, I don't think the press is lived up as well as it could have, as well as we should have, to our responsibilities to the public trust of giving integrity-filled journalism at the most important turns, decisions being made about peace or war, presidential elections. But there is a tendency in the public to look for someone to blame when things don't go right or things don't go your way, whether you're one side or the other. And I'm simply suggesting that particularly in hotly contested election campaigns, there's a tendency to adopt that Washington theory that goes, don't blame you, don't blame me, blame that fellow behind the tree. It works in Washington all the time. There's a version of that with the press, which is to blame the press for everything wrong with the system and not finding out things or people not seeing things your way. I see some encouragement, and I could be wrong about this, but I think having gone through what I deem to be a deep valley of fear and concern about being called unpatriotic or something along those lines, in the late 90s, particularly fading on into the early part of this century, I see some faint signs, more than faint, that some in the press are trying to get back to the traditional role of trying to separate brass tacks from spin and propaganda. And there are some people during this campaign, some organizations, some individual reporters, that I think deserve some praise. I'm not going to name names because I think it would be difficult. But I see some signs of making it better. But this much I will say, and then we get on to the next question, that if you want a better press, I prefer the word press to media, if you want a better media, then these are things you can do. One, when you see somebody doing a good job or hear somebody a good job, then let people know about it, and most particularly let their bosses know about it. Number two, when you see someone doing something that is clearly outrageous or not meeting their public trust, insofar as you can separate your own partisan political feelings from that, which is very difficult, then also let that be known. That in many ways, the press is, and I include myself in this, unfortunately, the press is a little bit afraid. And fear is not the proper role for any journalist. And I'll tell you exactly when the fear manifests itself the most. Number one, it's in time of war to be called unpatriotic or something worse. That will work on your brain. work on your insides, and your fears also will work on your boss, if you follow me. And particularly in large conglomerate international companies, this is a real problem, who have their own agendas in Washington for regulatory and legislative means. So all the more important to look at a number of different places and say, I think this person's doing a good job. Support that person, that enterprise. You can make a difference. Probably another speech for another day, so we'll leave it at that and take the next question. Yes, sir.
How can young people be expected to go out and vote as soon as they turn 18? How can we be expected to know how our government functions, the importance of our vote, and how our vote will make a difference if we're not taught how civics in school? What can we do as a generation in order to avoid this lack of civic knowledge and patriotic actions in future generations?
Thank you. What can you do? This is a case of teach yourself. If you want to be educated in civic affairs, how the government works, it's always good to take a class. It's always good to have somebody teach you, but take responsibility yourself. And if you believe it isn't being taught as it should be taught to younger people who come up behind you, then take the responsibility as best you can to make a difference. If you are determined, if you will be persistent, one person can make a difference. And if in no other way, one person can make a difference because one person can inspire other people. One person can inspire at least one other person, and then it grows on itself. And whatever it is, whether it's teaching physics better, getting to the polls, I encourage those of you who are young to believe, because it's true, that you can make a difference, that hearts can inspire other hearts with their fire. We're near the end. I'm so sorry I'm not going to be able to take any more questions because we need to go. I want to tell you one quick story, which I said before in the Kissinger line has the added advantage of being true. After I graduated from Sam Houston, I went for a brief time in the Marines. I have one of the shortest and least distinguished careers in the whole history of the Marine Corps. But I came out, and I was looking for a job. And this may resonate with you. We were in a recession of sorts, and jobs were hard to come by. I didn't keep my job at the newspaper, basically because I was an atrocious speller. If we'd had spell check on a computer, I'd still probably be in the newspaper business. But nonetheless, I wound up in radio. Nonetheless, I came back to my hometown, Houston, and my father, who, well, like a lot of men of his age and in his era, did not finish high school because the Depression was on. Somebody worked his back and his hands all of his life. But nonetheless, my father knew somebody who knew somebody, and my father's friend said, you know, Rags, young Dan's on the radio now, and radio's, you know, having get your name branded about is very important part of it, and I know somebody at the Lions Club who can invite him to speak. My father said, well, you know, you probably ought to speak to Dan about it. Anyway, things worked out. I was invited to speak to the Houston Lions Club. Now, it being Texas, I don't know whether it's true or not, but at that time they claimed to be the largest Lions Club in the world. And they met every week on Tuesdays at the Rice Hotel, which was the rough equivalent of the Four Seasons or something today. And I was invited to speak to the Lions Club. Big deal. The man who agreed to have me on the program called me and he said, Dan, he said, you're a little young for us. We don't normally have people, but we're going to have you speak, but you're going to speak for a half hour and only a half hour. I'm calling you to tell you, you'll be on at 1 o'clock and you have to be off at 1:30. We have a lot of business people and they'll leave. They'll get up and they'll start leaving the hall. And I said, yes, sir, I've got it. His name is McManus. I have it. I wrote the speech. I practiced the speech in front of my wife, in front of the mirror, in front of the dog. Anybody would listen. And I had this speech zeroed in, completely in my mind. I got to the Lions Club. Now, any of you who have ever been to Lions Club meetings before, you know what they do at Lions Clubs. They do a lot of other things besides hear speakers. They sing. They take up collections. They roar. They do all kinds of things. Well, 1 o'clock came. And 1:05 rolled by. I had not been called on. 1:10 came, 1:11 came. But I knew this speech so well, I had written it myself, memorized it, practiced it, was even saying it under my breath while we were sitting up there. Said, no problem. I'll take out four graphs here, five paragraphs there, rip out this page in my head, no sweat. 120 comes and goes. 125 came and went. It got to be about 127, 128. I'm sitting there getting smaller in my chair saying, ooh, boy, maybe all I'll do is get up and say, my name is Rather, and I'm real glad to be here. Thank you very much. Well, 129 passes, 130 comes, and when 130 came, the man who's in charge of the program, the man who'd invited me to speak, he tapped on the water glass, tap, 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 he says, Lions, time to roar. They roared, and they all began to leave. I'm sitting there absolutely stunned. I don't know what to do. I don't know whether to bark at the moon or wind my watch. And so as they all filed out, I finally said, you know what? They're never going to. He said to me, he said, you know, young Rather, I'm sorry we didn't get to you. We'll invite you another time. Goodbye. I said, they're never going to invite me back. This is my shot here. So I'm just going to get up, and it's in the Rice Hotel. It's in this big ballroom. So I got up to start to deliver the speech and, you know, stood like the speech teacher always told you sideways, delivering my speech with great gusto. I got about three paragraphs in, and I noticed the local sports writer, Morris Frank, was seated way along the right-hand wall. And I stopped and I said, you know, Mr. Frank, I really appreciate you staying on, but obviously I'm just doing this for my own edification, and you don't have to stay. And he shot back at me in a loud, strong voice and said, hell, boy, get on with it. I am the next speaker. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thanks.
Legendary television journalist and news anchor Dan Rather on Boston University's World of Ideas, speaking at a recent celebration marking the 45th anniversary of the Howard Gotlieb Archival Research Center. Mr. Rather was introduced by Dr. John LaRosa, president of the Friends of the Libraries at Boston University. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Jared Mooney. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.